This is Ray Taberski, and I did an interview with Drew Masiak, who is the author of Edmund Burke in America, The Contested Career of the Father of Modern Conservatism, for New Books in Intellectual History. This is a really fine book by Drew. He wrote about not just Edmund Burke's philosophy, but how his thought was received in the United States and how it's been used by a variety of different types of American thinkers, writers, politicians over the course of American history. So his book begins around the time of Burke's sort of rise to fame in the late 18th century. But he brings the story right up to the present. And the bulk of the book is really in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th century, with a little bit on the post-war era, especially a great chapter on natural law. It's a really fine book. The interview was really interesting, and I think listeners to New Books Network and subscribers to Society of U.S. Intellectual History will find what Drew has to say to be really, really good stuff. Hi, Drew. This is New Books Network, and it's really a pleasure to have you on the show. So our guest today is Drew Masiak. He is the author of Edmund Burke in America, The Contested Career of the Father of Modern Conservatism. Drew, this was a great, great read, I have to tell you. Yeah. It's really well written. It flows very nicely. And I think one of the things that I appreciated most about your book is that it wasn't a contemporary take on American conservatism. You didn't allow the present day to influence all the things that you were talking about when it came to Burke. But what I'd like you to do is, if you could, is tell us a little bit about yourself, sort of educational background, and how you came to this topic and how you began to write the book.
Let me just hit the highlights about who I am. Let me
sure.
give you the basic sort of resume details. First of all, I completed my PhD in American history at the University of Rochester in 2005. The dissertation was Edmund Burke and American Civilization, which you might want to think of as the original draft of this book.
Right.
I then spent the next six consecutive years teaching U.S. history at two colleges right here in the local Rochester area. I'm originally from Connecticut, but I now live in Rochester, New York.
Okay.
The last 4 years were as a full-time visiting assistant professor, particularly at State University of New York at Geneseo,
Great.
Which is a very excellent school. It's one of the two most academically competitive campuses, and had a lot of great students. It was a great opportunity and a great experience. Unfortunately, due to state budget cuts, that job came to an end, and I decided to begin what I called a self-financed sabbatical to, among other things, get these publication projects that I've been working on finally launched and on their way. I suppose I'm generally classifiable as an intellectual historian with a political orientation.
Okay.
So, like the joke about the guy that it was delighted to find that he'd been speaking prose all his life. I have to say I didn't know I was an intellectual historian in both my master's degree program at Wesleyan University and then again here at Rochester. Other people told me that's what I was. I mean, that's fine. That's an honorable term. I don't run away from it. I didn't set out to do that. It just sort of came natural to me.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing I would mention is I would rather not have to mention this, but I think I should. Because I think it is relevant about my general approach to what I'm doing. And that is, I think what would distinguish me from the average person that you might be interviewing about their first book based on their dissertation is that I'm quite a bit older than the average person at the usual stage of development, which of course means that I changed careers.
Okay.
And in fact, I got out of college in the 1970s and had a quick succession of jobs. But then went back to school, went first to a computer institute at Wesleyan, and later went right after that, went to the University of Connecticut and got an MBA in finance.
Huh.
I then spent the next 10 years in the corporate world in Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay.
I used to computerize accounting systems and supervise a small unit of people who did foreclosure reporting for this giant corporation. And in the 1990s, I went through a career change, went to Wesleyan University and earned a master's degree, and then eventually came here to Rochester for the doctoral program. And the reason I think that's important is because, although I certainly like to think of myself as someone who can change with the times and is not frozen in the mud, I do think that it, to some extent, all of us are creatures of the era in which we came of age. And for me, that's the 1970s. It was a time before this age of fracture that we're in was really obvious.
Yeah.
It's a time when kind of looking at things in a more synthetic way, top-down way, a way where sort of government policy and leadership was still central, you know, carried over from the 60s to everyone's mind. And I think that to some extent that informs the way I approached history once I began doing it.
That's interesting. I mean, did you have a sort of bent in this direction in high school?
It's very difficult for me now to remember back that far.
Yeah.
I did not major in history in college.
Right.
I'll tell you what I was. I don't think the species exists anymore. During the 1980s, when I was in the corporate world, I think I was the prototypical example of the that elusive general educated reader.
Right, right.
I was working doing what I told you I was doing.
Yeah.
But in my spare time, I just read from, I was not a TV watcher in those days, and I just read a tremendous amount. I was not doing it systematically, but now in retrospect, what I almost exclusively was reading was history and biography. So you could, if you want to, read back that this.
Yeah.
What I finally did became natural. You know, sooner or later, I decided I wanted to do this myself, and that accounts for the career change.
Was there? I mean, were there people that you were reading that that you can remember that had a certain sort of influence on how you began to think about a second career?
I think that what I did when I read, as I said, mostly history and biography.
Yeah.
Was I tended to, it's sort of really presentism in action.
Yeah.
I tended to just obviously see the roots of some of the issues of political debate, and by the 80s, the ideological debate that was beginning to go on, and realize, and I think that also helps you get a little older, to get past the age of 30, it's easier to imagine what the world was like before you existed or before you became aware of things.
Right.
And realize that you were part of a continuum. What was going on at the moment was part of a continuum.
Right.
And I think that's what hooked me into that.
So what made you choose Rochester?
When I was at Wesleyan, I got a master's degree in social studies with a concentration in American economic history.
Okay.
And at that time, I was planning to do economic history. In fact, my advisor was actually the chair of the economics department, although we had happened to do economic history by then. But kept telling me that really I'm intellectual historian. My master's thesis was on scientific management and the birth of planning, you know, Taylorism.
Sure. Great stuff.
Like rationality to everything. So I got interested in that, and I started looking at graduate programs in a number of fields, but eventually focused on history. And then as the sort of the second act of that process, I became aware of Rochester. I became aware of Christopher Lash, who, by the way, just died the year I was doing that.
Yeah.
Rob Westbrook and so on, and also some of the people in the past there. So it was one of the places that I applied to, and fortunately I got a full graduate fellowship. And while I was here, I still intended to pursue at the beginning economic history. In fact, I did a year of directed studies with Stan Engerman, who's a famous economic historian here at Rochester.
Yep, excellent.
But for whatever reason, by the time it came to putting together a dissertation prospectus, I think the intellectual and cultural history climate of the Department of History here at the U of R rubbed off on me enough that I sort of parked the economic business on the side, on a siding, which it's been there ever since, and went in this direction. Although the Burke topic itself really was didn't surface until the school fall starts.
Okay. I was wondering, whether people at Rochester, because I know a few of the people that have gone through the PhD program there. One you know, Dave Steigerwald in particular that I'm pretty close to. Were the people there that you worked with that were especially influential on your development?
Well, I mean, number one on the list obviously has to be Rob Westbrook, who's my advisor, a well-known intellectual historian in his own right, author of John Dewey and American Democracy.
Right.
And all of that. We also had, you know, a bunch of graduate students at the time where Rob Vanderlyn, John Summers, Patrick Lepierre, others who were interested in work that was sort of in the general cluster of what I was interested in.
Right.
So it was a very vibrant, if small, intellectual climate there. I think, you know, pound for pound, it stacks up against any place in the country.
Yeah.
When it came time to do this, I really was allowed, and I've heard horror stories from other people who go through other universities who say they're kind of encouraged or coerced into doing certain type of work.
Right.
I have to say over here, I've really had a carte blanche to do what interested me.
Yeah.
As long as I could build a good case for it. And I think that, you know, at the time I began this work project, there was no indication that at the time I was either mistakenly or not under the impression that intellectual history itself was sort of in decline as a field of interest. Certainly the dead white male family branch of it seemed to be.
Right.
There was the Anglo-American branch that seemed to be. This new wave of books on American conservatism was not yet apparent. I began this in 1999.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
So these new, there was no sign that they were on the horizon. It's just kind of a fortunate coincidence that by the time, you know, it took 6 years to do this, and then for a variety of reasons, it took another 8 years before it appeared as a book. And during that period of time, both intellectual history has revitalized somewhat, and this new wave of books on the history of conservatism in America has realized itself. There's, I think, also a bit of interest in Burke himself. There's another biography or book that was Burke that was published almost the exact time as my book, that's getting a lot of attention. I did it because I was interested in it myself, but I do think it is now in sync with some trends that are going on. I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I mean, let me ask you about that a little bit, because as you know, this is for a network that looks at academic books, but it's also going to be posted at the Society for U.S. Intellectual History's website.
Right.
And so where do you see yourself among sort of the trends in intellectual history right now?
I, again, would consider myself a hybrid of political and intellectual. I guess, you know, there are different ways of defining intellectual history. Strangely or not, I've never been particularly into philosophy per se, despite the fact that I once got the only A in a course on philosophy of Plato. That's highly misleading. The more practical I could see the consequences of thought,
yeah,
can be related to policy or the way I see people behaving in the real world,
yeah,
the more I am interested in it.
Yeah.
So, number one, I don't consider myself, a standalone intellectual historian. It's going to be linked to political, or economic,
right,
or notions of leadership.
Well, do you see intellectual history doing that fairly well these days? I mean, is it something that that maybe people didn't have a you know, the best sort of definition for? In fact, it does bring together all these streams of thought, the kind of things that you like, and bring together leadership, politics, economics, as well as sort of the history of ideas.
I think it might be. I think I see some encouraging signs. I think it's in the process, and maybe you disagree with this, if you'll chime in, of sort of reconstituting itself. I do think that the intellectual history as it existed in the heyday of, assuming it was a heyday, you know, the post-war era, kind of deteriorated after a while. But in some ways, it was a victim of social history, bottom-up history.
Right, right.
The fragmentation of all kinds of new fields. And then if it is indeed in a phase of reconstitution right now, which I hope it is, I think there are two questions to be answered. Number one, how influential will it be beyond its own field? I mean, historians in general, readers in general, be interested in it, or is it going to be just kind of arguments within the family? And the other one, which I think addresses the question you asked, is exactly what shape it's going to take, I honestly can't project that. I think it's still forming. I think another, I mean, one trend I see that my book, again, it goes back to that business about learning that you've been speaking prose.
Yeah.
I think another way to categorize the particular approach in this book, which it shares with, I think, Jennifer's American Nietzsche book, which mm-hmm. is an excellent book that's getting a lot of attention, is that I was also, I think, writing reception history without knowing about it.
Right, and yeah, it. Absolutely.
These Americans were reading Edmund Burke, not the way you and I might dissect him in a purely, if you're writing an article for some political science journal to dissect his thought. They were really consulting him and experiencing him to figure out their own situation in America of their own time, to help them understand what was going on. And so, therefore, it's not only what Burke says, it's what they think he said. It's reacting to just the name and reputation of Edmund Burke and so on.
Yeah.
And I think that's what helps link this book to reality. And I think it also maybe differentiates it from the way this book may have been written by somebody in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, so that's let's jump off from there, because it seems to me that you know, a good part of this book is reception history, but it's also reclamation of Burke's legacy and trying to put him into historical context that is not driven by, you know, David Brooks or even Russell Kirk, but
right,
a much longer a thread. So could you tell me when you finally turned, you know, the page proofs in and you were thinking about how to describe what this book was supposed to do with Burke, I mean, how would you tell people what you had just done?
What I tell people is this book, although it says an awful lot about Edmund Burke, in the first chapter it's about Burke, and then interspersed through the rest of the book is discussion of Burke himself.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, the book is more about America, it's more about American history
yeah.
than it is about Burke.
Yeah.
Burke, or that is the response or the reaction to Burke, is really the particular lens that is used. And I think one of the things that this reveals, this story that begins in the 1790s, and goes almost to the present, although I would have to say the real tight coverage really extends to the post-war era. The last few decades
That's
are
right.
covered more likely. That was done intentionally.
Right.
But one thing it reveals is there was this contention over American ideals, what type of society, what America was supposed to stand for, what were its virtues, what made it different, what made it exceptional, what type of society or civilization were Americans trying to build. And in general, you can divide that into, again, loosely defined conservative and liberal camps going back from the beginning. The terms liberal and conservative themselves did not exist in the political context in Burke's day. As you probably know, they date from the early 19th century.
Right.
And then they changed what they actually meant, changed on a roughly generational basis. And even at any given moment in time, they could mean more than one thing. Of course, everyone knows today conservatism, we talk about it, is paleoconservatism, neoconservatism,
right.
libertarian, and so on. And you can do the same thing with liberalism.
Yeah.
So while the terms themselves are slippery, I think most people, you know, like pornography, most people know what conservatism is or liberalism is when they
see it. Yeah.
And if they're not able to define precisely. But, you know, there are certain predilections about conservatives favoring order and stability and tradition and certain things like that. Liberals favoring more innovation and humanitarianism and quest for justice and so on. And you can see these things play out against each other.
That yeah.
is. And neither one is really definable except in relation to the other.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the things that this book does.
Yeah, I mean,
there were other ways that someone could have covered this liberal conservative
right,
debate throughout
right.
the course of American history, and I happen to use Edmund Burke as the opening in which to do that.
Yeah, I think if I can add my two cents on this, one of the things I found fascinating was that we often get confused when we try to talk about liberal and conservatism, because of course the words have changed over 200 years, right? The definitions and who gets to be liberal and conservative. But the thing I really liked about your book was that you set up the poles not in the isms, but in the American Revolution and the French Revolution. And you try to demonstrate how Burke, who lived through both, who wrote about both, who had strong reactions to both, how he tried to parse out what the historical lineages of the two revolutions were, how people began to use the revolutions, and what, in a way, the memories of the revolutions have been since their time. And that, to me, you know, is sort of like the touchstone. It's the foundation for almost everything that we talk about in Western political thought, those two sort of pivotal moments, you know.
Right, and that's why Burke is such a good lens to use, because he lived through and at least verbally, you know, participated in both of those events.
Yeah.
And he, as I say at one point in there, he was neither a liberal nor a conservative by today's definition.
Right.
His, what I call his Whig vision, did contain both proto-liberal and proto-conservative elements in
right.
it. And then circumstances, the particular issue he was addressing at the time would depend on, would determine which of those two surfaced. If he was talking about slavery or India, the liberal component, or the American Revolution, the proto-liberal component tended to dominate. Of course, the French Revolution and some other issues, but most famously the French Revolution, his proto-conservatism, and even his reactionaryism, and that's really the only major issue on which Burke was really reactionary. And so we could see that whole myriad of responses in Burke. And then, as you say, we can see how that plays out with others. And it's interesting to see, you know, what people pick out of Burke and what they ignore. And
right.
I think, you know, during the Cold War in the 1950s, his critique of the Jacobins in the French Revolution was almost all of Burke, because it seemed to relate so well to Stalinist communism. If you go back to the early 19th century, you'll find Emerson or other people talking about Burke, and they barely mention the French Revolution. They just kind of dismiss it. So, you know, it's another example of the reception history nature of that. I mean, people are interested in Burke, and they see in him what is relevant to the paradigms of their own day.
Yeah, so one of my questions that I had after finishing the book was, do you think it's fair to say that the most significant aspect of Burke are his reactions to the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and how he saw sort of the imperial legacy, in a sense, the imperial legacy of the ideas that came out of those revolutions playing out over time, what he thought might happen? I mean, is that what we should be most concerned about when we think about Burke?
It's interesting. Imperialism is kind of an interesting subtopic, or colonialism, either, you know, in regard to Burke.
Yeah.
Because especially in the 1950s, you know, some conservatives were claiming, in the 1960s, they were claiming that Burke would have been a hawk on the war in Vietnam. Now, that's entirely possible, because I'm sure that Burke would have hated communism.
Right.
But if you look at the Vietnam situation as a neo-colonial drama,
right,
which is certainly a plausible way of looking at it,
right,
you wonder whether Burke would indeed have favored American intervention. The colonial or imperial issues that surfaced widely during Burke's day, and let me just parenthetically add here, I'd say that I would not limit the important aspects of Burke to that, because there are many other things, his defense, political parties, all kinds of other things that are equally important. But getting back to your question about imperialism, first of all, America. Burke certainly wanted the North American British colonies. Burke certainly wanted to keep those colonies under the wing of the British Empire. He believed that the colonies were headed for trouble if they separated. He thought they would fight amongst each other. Without the protection of the British Constitution and the British Empire, America wasn't going to survive. He believed that an experiment with democracy would survive. Nevertheless, mm-hmm. he opposed his own government's harsh policies toward the colonies, because he thought they were just misguided. They were depriving the colonists of their own inherited British constitutional rights, and so on. Now in England, in India, his other big colonial crusade, Burke was a fierce opposition over a long period of years against the East India Company, especially under Warren Hastings, the Governor General, who tried to impeach, because he thought that England was unjustifiably exploiting India for profit. It was damaging British society and the British constitution, as well as raping India. He thought that India actually had an ancient and venerable, and therefore worthy of respect, civilization of its own religion, its own hierarchy that's going to govern processing and all of that business, and that, in both cases, he favored a sort of a lighter and more respectable oversight of those colonies. But he still favored having the British Empire. I mean, he was not like a 20th century anti-colonialist. He favored the Empire with,
right.
Kind of like Winston Churchill did, who was an admirer of Burke.
Right.
France was, I think of that more in ideological terms. What Burke was concerned of, his most famous work is Reflections on the Revolution of France, which was published in the fall of 1790, and Burke's historical reputation is mostly built, what he's most famous for, for better or worse, is his critique of the French Revolution. In that, he was not so much worried about France. What he was worried about is that the dangerous ideas that underlie the French Revolution might jump the channel and affect England, Great Britain, his known world, and destroy civilization as he knew it.
Yeah.
He already saw it beginning to spread. The war already broke out, and he lived long enough to see the beginnings of Napoleon's rise. He died before the height of the Napoleonic era, but he already saw that in the works. Burke died in July of 1797. So he was really afraid. He likened the French Revolution to the Reformation, and he said that just like the Reformation couldn't be confirmed, it was the new ideas about religion, salvation by faith or by works, things like that, couldn't be confined to Germany. If they are true there, if these new ideas catch on there, then why aren't they applicable to everywhere else?
Yeah.
That's what happened with the Revolution. That's what happens with the Enlightenment. And that could be what's happening with the French Revolution.
My interest in your characterization of Burke's sort of relationship to these two revolutions was that you seem to be getting at these sort of the fundamental questions that both revolutions asked. And by Burke asking these almost a particular set of questions on both revolutions that happened so close to each other, that he was getting at some sort of fundamental source of human nature or of civilization based on a certain type of human nature. And it's something that gets resurrected in different ways after his death. But that it seemed to me you were trying to bring us back to a much fuller contextual reading of those questions. What was it that bothered Burke most specially about the American Revolution, the French Revolution, was not what we celebrate or what we condemn necessarily these days? It's not that the French Revolution leads directly to Stalin. That wasn't what Burke was sort of fearful of having happen, but that there is something tragic in the sense that people weren't asking particular questions that he thought needed to be asked.
Right. And I think I think the way I would differentiate the two is the American Revolution. And I believe this is in some sense accurate to the early stages, part of the motivation, which Burke saw as more as a restoration.
Yeah.
He saw that what his own government was doing at the time was usurping their authority and really depriving Americans of what their natural and British rights were, doing it in a heavy-handed way. Whereas he saw the French Revolution as something of an entirely different species, which is why, by the way, his Reflections was a response to a piece by Price, which linked together the American Revolution of 1776, the British so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688-89,
right,
and the French Revolution. Burke said the Glorious Revolution and the American Revolution, not necessarily the American War for Independence, but those were basically a restoration of traditional constitutional principles. And they were in line with, as you said, with human nature and the history of those particular nations.
Yeah.
Whereas the French Revolution is something completely different.
Yeah.
Here you get a bunch of speculative philosophers who are trying to just wipe the slate completely clean, the slate of the French national history and of human nature, and to try to restart everything new. You throw out the calendar and throughout religion and briefly turned Notre Dame into a temple of reason and all of that. And what you're trying to do is take some utopian speculative design and impose it on people. And that conflicts with human nature and with the history of that particular civilization. And that's why it's bound for trouble. So he saw very little relationship between the American Revolution and the Glorious Revolution in America and Britain, respectively, and the French Revolution, which is why in the 1950s, anti-communists made that connection to the French Revolution. They were saying that's what Marxists want to do. Mm-hmm. They want to make people, you know, stifle individual initiative, make everybody be more collectivist, and they want to throw out religion. You know, it's officially atheistic, and, you know, they're only going to be able to do this through force because it goes against human nature. And what we're seeing happen in Stalinist Russia is what happened during the reign, or at least it's analogous to what happened during the Reign of Terror in France in the 1790s.
Yeah. Okay. I find, you know, one of the other big themes that comes out, and I think this will get us, you know, take us away from focusing on Burke's view of the French Revolution, was his view of continuity and change. Because I think, when you're writing the book, are you responding to those who see Burke as sort of an entrenched, almost aristocratic conservative in a sense this guy, you know, who's so dead to the ideas of change and to the ideas of any kind of democracy. And, you know, again, your portrait of him is much more complicated. This is not a guy who is going to praise, you know, the aristocrats of Downton Abbey simply because they're wealthy, you know.
Right.
So tell me a bit more about how you see Burke's image in relation to the broader historical understanding of continuity and change, and maybe perhaps in contrast to somebody like Dewey, who has been sort of seen as a savior in many ways to American intellectuals for most of the latter half of the 20th century.
Right, which is why Dewey was particularly hated by the Burkean revivalists especially those of the Natural Law School of the 1950s and late 40s, because they saw pragmatism and they saw Dewey as someone who threw out the old certainties, and there are no truths. I think one of the folks, I can't put it exactly, there are no truths, but only, you know, ambulatory changing truths that are used for as long as they work. Once they don't work anymore, they're thrown out and replaced by new truths. Anyway, and well, their stereotypic view of Burke would be that Burke, more or less, as you hinted at in your question, opposed all change and was kind of the stick in the mud.
Yeah.
In fact, Burke championed quite a bit of change, and not necessarily incremental in the terms of, you know, spooning out little teaspoons of change. Sometimes he acknowledged that the changes have to be relatively large. He's got a famous quote, and again, this is a paraphrase, but it's almost exact. He says something like, "A state without the means of some change is without the means of its own conservation."
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you can't stand, so you have to make minor changes or you're going to far. And then further down, he says something like, he's devoted to two principles. One is conservation and the other is correction. Well, you know, correction means incremental change. It's not revolutionary change. It's not wiping everything out and starting afresh, but it is making reforms when they need to be made. And again, until the French Revolution, Burke pretty much stood for that.
Yeah.
Which is something that a lot of his conservative admirers really don't, either they don't understand that or know that about him, or they choose for polemical reasons to just ignore that side of him. But Burke, you know, was relatively flexible. Now, on the other hand, I have to say he was willing to go so far and no farther. As you yourself said, he was not a Democrat the way we would use the term today. He was certainly against authoritarian rule by the king, but he favored some type of more oligarchical form of leadership. He thought that popular opinion was very important, and that the natural leaders of society should pay close attention to that.
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing as saying that everyone in Britain, or even all the males in Britain, should be allowed to vote, or in the United States, for that matter. So on that point, I think I would cite George Bancroft, the Democratic historian of the, back in the antebellum era, who said that he admired Burke a lot, but that it seemed that Burke was something like he was poised to gaze into futurity, and yet, you know, very flowery language in those days, and yet it was not yet meant to be. You know, Brooks saw the future, and he just didn't have, these are my words, paraphrasing Bancroft, but he didn't have either the guts or the vision or the imagination or the confidence to take that leap into the new democratic egalitarian world that had become the norm,
yeah.
You know, by the era of Jacksonian democracy.
Right.
So Brooks was a reformer by the standards of the late 18th century, but he was willing to go only so far.
Okay, so can I bring somebody like Corey Robbins' book into this discussion just a little bit? Have you discussed with him at all his view of Burke and conservatism?
I have not. I did take a look at his book a while back, and I don't really recall the specifics. I did send him some information about the book,
yeah.
But I did not get a detailed response. But I know, it, you know, the subtitle is, I believe the subtitle is, I think the book is The Reactionary Mind,
yeah.
From Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin.
Right.
First of all, I'm offended by comparing Sarah Palin to Edmund Burke. You can agree with Edmund Burke or not, but, intellectually speaking, Edmund Burke was a giant compared to Sarah Palin. But the other thing about Sarah Palin, I don't want to pick on Sarah Palin either because it's
no.
The target. But what I mean is, if you're talking about such a simplistic version of conservatism of Sarah Palin or Rush Limbaugh or O'Reilly or things like that, you're doing injustice even to the conservatism of Burke. Even if you want to endorse the conservatism of Burke, it was a much more nuanced and multifaceted and much more flexible. You know, Burke was always defending the British Constitution, but if you look at what he says about it in different venues and on different topics, he was very flexible in its interpretation. I mean, he's not a strict constructionist.
Yeah.
What I say in the book is that a lot of his conservative or reactionary admirers in the 20th century are really more fundamentalist in outlook than they are conservative in outlook,
yeah.
Which is exactly not what Burke was.
So would you say it seems to me that the great critique, and I think Robin brings this out in his book, the great critique of Burke is that at his core, he would like to preserve power for an elite that only he can identify, and others will then take up the same sort of cause. You know, they will identify an elite that they would like to keep power for and not extend it beyond that. And they will make up lots of different arguments to make sure that this is, you know, allowed.
That argument is an argument that has been present among left-leaning intellectuals for a while. There was a book that was published, I'm going to say 1980, but mm-hmm. not going to be exact year. It's published by C.B. McPherson, the Canadian political scientist.
Okay.
I think it's just called Edmund Burke.
Yeah.
It's a short book, but basically, are you familiar with it?
I'm not.
Okay. The argument of that book is basically the reason why conservatives like Burke now, you know, circa 1980s, but at the dawn, this is a sort of, in a way, an anticipation of the Reagan greed is good decade, is that Burke used his arguments to defend the hereditary aristocracy and that order in his day, and now, circa 1980, conservatives are using that same argument to shore up a new aristocratic order, which is a plutocratic order. In other words, it's this top-down natural aristocracy where
right.
the common people need to be led is now an economic ascendancy that people want to, freeze in place, preserve, and defend, and they're using Burke's arguments. They're just shifting which aristocracy, which natural leaders of society it is. It is no longer the hereditary aristocracy and the responsible gentry. Now it's the economic elites and their defenders.
Yeah.
So that is a thing that has cropped up from time to time. I mean, it does have, just in of itself, it has a surface plausibility. I wouldn't dismiss it outright. I mean, I'm sure some people are doing that, but that really, I think, just turns the whole Burkean philosophy into sort of some cartoon character. I mean, I think it's just to leave it at that is doing an injustice.
And, okay, why is that?
You know, especially since a lot of the conservatives who praised Burke were not really defenders of the of the economic order. I mean, people like Russell Kirk and others,
right,
who had more of a cultural approach. They were against materialism and consumerism and the military-industrial complex. So, you know, they were not really going out of their way to defend the plutocracy.
Well, you certainly make a distinction between somebody like Kirk and Hayek when it came to their relationships to Burke.
Right. I mean, Hayek was not a Burkean.
Yeah.
You know, although he was an old, Austrian aristocrat.
Yeah. I mean,
but Burke is a libertarian, economic libertarian conservative.
Yeah.
Really, his approach is really ahistorical. By the way, I read a lot of Hayek when I was doing my economic history book years back. And let me just say, it has nothing to do with our discussion, but even Hayek is a lot more complicated than people think he
is. Okay. Okay.
The other thing about Hayek, he writes very great discursive footnotes, essays in and of themselves. But getting back to your question, there couldn't be a wider gulf between Hayek and Kirk, which is why Hayek himself refused to call himself a conservative. He called himself, you know, like a classical liberal. He was a libertarian, economic liberal, and which is really, as I said, a historical approach or a utilitarian approach. Russell Kirk was completely different. Russell Kirk had a much more of a historical continuity. Certainly no faith in the kind of rational economic calculation that Hayek had. So the two of them, what united them and what united a lot of conservatives of their generation was just their opposition to what was then dominant left of center thought.
Right.
But they were really united more by what they opposed than by what they stood for in terms of the different branches of conservatism.
Yeah.
Hayek was no Burke.
Yeah.
Russell Kirk was, if you buy into a certain version.
Right. Right. I mean, I think one of the things that I liked about your book, as well as just learning a great deal about Burke that I did not know, is that you have this really nice way of introducing aspects of American history in a fairly short amount of space. And then,
you know, Ray, that is a consequence, both good and bad, about waiting so long to write your first book. You want to have kill multiple birds with one stone.
Yeah.
You end up grazing a lot of the birds, maybe. But yeah, there were, and then, by the way, by design, each individual chapter also had sort of a secondary and tertiary theme and subject.
Clearly.
It's supposed to be user transparent. It's not supposed to get in the way. It's just supposed to be there. And I see that you have very perceptively picked that out. I don't know if it's necessarily that obvious to the first-time reader. But yeah, that was done on purpose. I did try to put an awful lot in there. That has both positive and negative consequences.
Well, no, I think it's interesting because it'll set up the discussion that you're about to have with Burke. You know, if it's about American exceptionalism, you know, you give a nice sketch of what we're talking about and what period of what type of American exceptionalism we're going to talk about. If it's we're talking about progressivism and sort of the Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson ideas of change, you give a sort of a nice summary of, you know, so what do we need to deal with? What were the questions that, again, Burke's philosophy or his intellectual curiosity, what kind of questions does he raise that we need to consider when we think about what aspect of American democracy we're about to approach?
Right, in those particular times.
Like,
right,
exactly.
An excellent job of summing up the different parts of it. That's exactly right.
And,
which is why the issues that Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson addressed were different than the ones that, you know, George Bancroft or Rufus Choate or Joseph Story or John Adams.
Yeah, right.
John Adams was, you know, obsessed with the constitutionalism and all of that. So there were different varieties throughout history, you know, including after the 9/11 attack. So that is, that is certainly one of the things I was trying to portray in the book.
I mean, so
You know, one reason why it took so long to, I mean, there was a lot of things to look at.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, it's a history of the United States.
I'm going on to other things, but they're not going to be this was a labor intensive bear. I mean, I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
Do something of value, but this particular type of heavy lifting, I think I have one of those in me.
Well, can I ask you, I mean, have you had, can you give us a sense of what the reception has been to your book?
I don't know. You know, this book has been out for like 2 months. And as far, I've gotten a lot of, as I'm getting from you, I've gotten a lot of informal, positive reception.
Right.
I've yet to get negative. I wonder if just those people aren't the ones that are gonna let you know. Now, the publisher, Cornell, has gotten many requests from many periodicals for copies to review and all. As we speak this morning, as far as I know, and I checked with Cornell by email the day before yesterday and got a response yesterday, as far as I know, there are no reviews published yet on this book. I did get – there was a piece in the Financial Times of London 2 weeks ago that looked like it was going to be a joint review of my book and Jesse Norman's book on Edmund Burke. But it turned out to be more of a 6 or 8 sentence mention in the middle of a long article rather than an actual review.
Yeah.
So I'm really still – I mean, the jury is still out. I'm still cautiously optimistic, but I have not yet gotten any concrete feedback. Now, there's supposed to be an article that's going to appear in The New Yorker either next week or the week after that supposedly considers this book in a broader discussion of work. I have no idea what the content is going to be of that.
Yeah.
But I really can't give you any I mean, how do you think I feel about that? I want to know more than you do.
Yeah, of course.
I guess it's too early to really to know.
Yeah, that's fair. One of the things that I find interesting, I mean, are there Burke societies that are going to take this up as, you know, the book that they'll read for the month and they'll have you come in? I mean, when I spoke to Jennifer Burns about her book on Ayn Rand, she said it was amazing how quickly she became the sort of celebrity among, you know, the Randians.
Yes. Okay. There are. And these are kind of spinoffs of Russell Kirk's institute, including his widow Annette and his brother-in-law Nelson and others, and the Journal of the University Bookman and all that. And I've been in partial contact with those people, and as they contacted me, I'm not sure yet. I've been told by an intermediary, I'm not going to mention the name, that Annette Kirk has had me looked into.
That's funny.
What that means, I don't know.
Yeah.
And that I've been asked to contribute a very short reflective piece on Russell Kirk to the University Bookman. I think I just emailed that off maybe before yesterday.
Yeah.
And supposedly they're going to review the book. You know, I did that little mini interview for the National Review online. And the editor of that said he's reviewing it. Again, to the best of my knowledge, it hasn't appeared yet. But so it looks like there is some kind of sizzling of action there. I'm not exactly sure what yet it's going to come to. I mean, this has certainly piqued their curiosity.
Oh, no doubt.
What they're going to do with me or my book, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just – so I have
I would certainly hope that even if they disagree with the take on Burke, that they at least respect it as a work of scholarship and some of the earlier historical points, even if they're going to disagree with the Cold War interpretation. Or
well, it's not a polemic. I mean, this is a really well done study.
I tried very hard to make until I got to the very last chapter where it was just impossible to not tip my hand a little bit. I mean, there's just no way to do that when you're talking about very recent events. But I tried very hard to present a fair and balanced, view and to make it a work of scholarship rather than a work of advocacy. And then when I was sending this to publish, in my cover letter, I actually put in bold that this is not a work of conservative advocacy. Yeah. It's a work of historical scholarship.
Right. Well, and then I have to ask you the question. I mean, was the father of modern conservatism, is that accurate?
It is and it isn't. I mean, it is in the sense that if you're going to say, if not Burke, then who?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there are other names you could throw up there, but, they're not necessarily convincing, on their own.
But he's not American conservatism.
It doesn't have one father the way sort of Marx and Engels, and particularly Marx, was the father of conservatism.
Yeah.
If you're looking for one name, I mean, it's not completely off the wall to pick Edmund Burke. And especially because, you have to ask the question, number one, to what degree can he be objectively or demonstrably said to be the father of conservatism? And then there's the other question, which is, and again, this is, I guess, getting more toward reception history or more toward practicality, if we get to a point where so many people see him as
yes,
the father
right.
of conservatism,
right.
it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely.
Anyway, unless you want to build a case to sort of disprove that, it's not completely errant to say that. I would just say to people, if you want to call Burke the father of conservatism, please get a more detailed and more varied understanding of what conservatism can be.
Yeah, because he's not the father of American conservatism. That's clear in your book,
not.
Right?
Definitely. Burke has almost nothing to do with, for example, what the Republican Party is doing today in the United States, as far as I can tell.
Right, or even John C. Calhoun, for that matter.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Burke is not really a father of American conservatism.
And where would you say, even though you set up sort of the Thomas Paine Burke feud there, why is it that Burke is then appropriated by certain people in the 19th century as someone to be used in America? What is it why is he allowed in a certain sense, or why is he able to become, in a sense, this great inspiration to American conservatism, even
right.
if he didn't care much about American thought?
Right. Again, it depends who you're talking about. But if you talk about, for example, the Whigs that I profile in the chapter on the
mm-hmm.
particularly Edward Everett, Ruth Choke, and
which is a really, really well done chapter, because it's a very complex chapter.
Thank you. And that one, again, that was one of the more labor-intensive.
Yeah, definitely.
A lot of time.
Joseph Story's thought is fascinating.
On things that were related that didn't even appear in the book. This is great. You've written multiple books, I'm sure, and even most of the people listening to this interview probably are aware that when you write a book, what appears in the book is the tip of the iceberg.
Right,
you really
absolutely.
Learn, 10 times as much, it never gets into the book. But that particular chapter on the Whigs had an awful lot to it. One of the common threads is this response to what they saw, I think, as the over-democratization of American society, and also what they saw as an excessive severance between American sort of exceptionalist civilization and the Anglo, the British civilization that they were breaking free from.
Yeah.
And they had some of these people were Anglophiles, particularly Edward Everett, and they saw Burke as representing a more stable and I would even say aristocratic condition that they saw threatened by by mob rule in a sense.
Yeah,
and I think on a more cultural level in the late 19th century, E.L. Dodkin fell in, especially the second half of his career, fell into that same trap. So I think that's one reason why these people were not particularly effective in making that argument. And as far as I know, and again, I spent a lot of time trying to scan the environment, you never know. This has covered so many years. I'm sure thousands and thousands and thousands of things have been published. But as far as I know, that was never, addressed or developed by anyone before. So there are little hints of it in Daniel Walker Howe's book on the American Whig.
Right.
But, nobody, I think, as far as I know, I'm the first person to develop it in any detail.
Yeah.
But again, that also, Ray, gets back to your earlier question about, this is a contestation over what American ideals are going to be.
Yeah.
How different are they going to be from the aristocratic British tradition? How different are they going to be from the British constitutional position?
Right.
And again, it depends. I should mention there's a very interesting part of the book that has been cut out. This book was originally much larger. This is only 58% of the original manuscript that made it through. I'm actually glad that Cornell made me do that because it makes it a smaller, more manageable book that's more approachable. It also sells for a very reasonable price, so it is good. Nevertheless, there are some interesting things that are no longer there, and I think the one I miss the most is that in the late antebellum period, certain writers used Burke's anti-Jacobin arguments to combat abolitionism and, saying that, this is the kind of radical thought that can, this moralistic radical thought that can cause society to spin out of control and the country to come apart and all of that. So, it disrespects the Constitution and, the original constitutional settlement and all of that business. So that's another example of people, appropriating Burke for the arguments of the immediate day.
Yeah. So, let's wrap up with one final question. And I think this is a thing that sort of hangs over all the book overall. Burke had a really fascinating critique of democracy. Right. And if democracy, you know, it doesn't end history, as we've seen. But if there were a set of questions that Burke wanted people to consider as they move through this his era of democracy and into the future, what were those? What was that set of questions?
I think that Burke would believe that people needed to always be sure that what the decisions they were making, I mean, I'm assuming the question, you know, given democracy like we have it now,
right.
What would Burke want people to keep in mind when they're making their decisions at the voting booth or whatever, that the decisions that they are going to make are grounded in practical experience and a realistic view of human nature, and also a realization that we are acting in the moment, we're acting in the present in a way that must be consistent with our past, and we are just part of a continuum, which is what is going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
So we have to be very careful about what we do. Now, of course, someone can appropriate that and use that to be extremely gun-shy about, you know, making any kind of changes.
Right. I mean,
you could oppose, say, the civil rights movement
or
giving women the vote or something like that. But on the other hand, you could go in the opposite direction and saying that, you know, the concept of mourning, like the dead hand of our fathers. And this is what some of the critics of Burke criticize him. They're claiming that, you know, he says we are living with an entailed inheritance and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that we are bound, you know, there's very little that we can legitimately do at the present moment to, you know, wiggle out of difficulties because, you know, we have to respect to a phenomenal degree what we have inherited. So it's all about where you want to place that where you want to place the limits of restraint.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, he's certainly against speculative thought, but, you know, as we know, radicalism, speculative thought, reform, all of those things, moderation, all of those things can often be in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
And it's very difficult at any moment to know, you know, what, you know, very often what people are doing is defined by their, you know, by their opponents, not by the, you know, everybody. The radicalism of most ideas is claimed by those who oppose them.
Oppose them, right.
Which is why I think it makes it very difficult to say, you know, if Edmund Burke were alive in the post-war era, if you're alive today, exactly what issues, you know, what would you know? It's easy to say he would have hated communism, but you know, I don't think anybody could say what Burke would have thought about, you know, gun control or stem cell research or you know. Lots of things that are on the agenda today. Healthcare, Obama, healthcare reform.
Yeah.
You know, very different. I mean, he certainly thought that society was a community. He was not an individualist, a libertarian. So he certainly saw the wisdom of collective action and of shared responsibility. Now, whether his version of shared responsibility can be painted as as a humanitarian communal effort, or whether one wants to contrast it to socialism, you know, that's another question.
Yeah. Okay, Drew, this was fascinating. Again,
well, thank you.
The book is Edmund Burke in America, The Contested Career of the Father of Modern Conservatism. Drew Masiak, thanks again.
Well, thank you, Ray. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to an interview with Drew Masiak on the New Books Network, New Books Intellectual History. I'm Ray Hiberski. Thanks for listening.